Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
In her latest cookbook, the British food writer Bea Wilson says, "There was a time when the store of cooking knowledge was inherited in families. It was passed along the generations, so recipes were like these collective memories. And before there were cookbooks, she says, there were things called books of secrets."
In a previous life, I was a historian, and I was aware that cookbooks, in a sense, are quite a modern invention. And for hundreds of years, cookbooks were not a common technology. There might be little manuscript collections that people would pass down in families. But what there were these published books of secrets. A book of secrets might contain anything. A potion for supposedly curing baldness. Poultices for sore feet. Ways to make someone happy if they had melancholy. Ways to make childbirth easier. And then suddenly, you get a recipe for jam, or a recipe for a delicious tart. In those books, cooking is treated as a kind of everyday magic, something that's both practical and wishful in a certain way. Cooking can still be a remedy.
You mentioned one recipe from 1591 that says, to make a tart, that is, courage to man or woman. That was the title of the recipe. What do you figure that was or means?
Yes, I think the idea of a tart that gives courage to anyone, I don't know, it sounds a ridiculous, far-fetched idea, doesn't it? But I go on to say, is it really any more ridiculous or far-fetched than a few years ago, there was a whole spate of cookbooks that were promising us wellness. Well, what is wellness, really? I mean, I think it's just that human life is full of grief and bad luck and major and minor disappointments. And there's something about a recipe that gives us a sense of certainty and a very reassuring narrative arc. Every recipe has a happy ending. And I sort of feel that there is still that spirit of magic in recipes, even if we might not be actually claiming that they're going to take away melancholy.
You write in the book how many of us have this kind of lost feeling in the kitchen these days. And I wanted to ask you about that because you suggest that things have changed. It seems like you're worried that we feel lost because we don't have the same connection to them.
Yeah, but I'm not saying we should be nostalgic for some past state of cooking. I am saying we feel lost. I mean, I felt a bit lost. That's part of why I wrote the book. I partly wrote it for myself, as someone who had loved to cook ever since I was a child. I mean, food is a passion. It's a necessity as well, but it's something absolutely that if I have lots of time and a free day and a well-stocked refrigerator and I've been to the farmer's market, what could be more enjoyable than cooking? But so often we're not cooking under those circumstances. We've got an overflowing email inbox. We've got a long to-do list. We're feeling mildly stressed. We're maybe cooking for other people, whether it's children or a partner or just friends who don't share our tastes and who are going to pick out the mushrooms or not be happy if we add chili to something. And so we're never cooking usually under circumstances that we've fully chosen. And though I really wrote this book for myself and my friends as much as anyone else, how, under all those circumstances of busyness that we all have, how can you find the joy and goodness in cooking then?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Bea Wilson is joining us for a conversation to get you in the right frame of mind for tomorrow, when you'll be thinking about the process of making food in a way you usually don't. Her book is called The Secret of Cooking, and it isn't actually about making a feast. It's about everyday cooking and how to make it feel less like an annoying chore. The hard part of cooking, then, isn't how to poach an egg or keep a sauce from separating. Wilson says the secret is how to get the spark of cooking back into our lives, to make the kitchen a place where you actually want to spend some time. We began with Wilson's own history with cooking, which began early in her life, where the kitchen was a place she went to cure her worries.
I was a very greedy child, and my mother was such a tolerant person in that she just kind of welcomed me into her kitchen and didn't mind too much when I took a load of ingredients and just covered the kitchen in a cloud of flour and butter and made a mess. I was aiming to cook from a very, very young age. I remember the first time my mother taught me, there's a recipe in the book for cauliflower cheese souffle, which is partly based on that. One of the very first things I learned to make from my mother was a cheese souffle. But I remember her just showing me how you separated the whites and the yolks from the eggs and you cracked them into two different basins and then you whisk the eggs. I mean, even just that, just watching the transformation of an egg white from something slimy and indeterminate to something cloud-like and white and beautiful. And then either my sister or I would be given the job of grating the cheese, and then we'd make the bechamel sauce. And there weren't that many stages. And then you'd put it in the oven and this beautiful, crusty, golden, cloud-like thing would come out and we'd all eat. And I can't really think of many other things at that young age that I'd ever experienced that were as, again, use the word transformational as that. So,
yeah,
cooking, I fairly early on just saw, this is great. I want more of this. And as soon as my mother would let me loose, I would just start cooking for myself.
But then the experience kind of changed. And this sort of gets us to the idea in the book. It changed from being this, you know, the kitchen, from this being the secret hideaway where you could ease your anxiety, into something that became, I guess, an actual source of anxiety. What changed? What was that transformation?
Well, I think that transformation crept up over many years. I mean, I'd say there was one stage of the kitchen suddenly becoming an unhappy place, which I write about a bit later in the book, where in my teenage years, my parents divorced, and around the same time both my sister and I just developed slightly, well, more than slightly, disordered relationship with food, where I suddenly was thinking, I can't eat that, I shouldn't eat that, that's bad, that's good, that's virtuous, that's forbidden. And as soon as you have that kind of chatter around food, how can you see the kitchen as the beautiful sanctuary that it had been before? So that was one phase of it suddenly becoming problematic and complicated. And then something I will just always be grateful for is something I've written about in another of my previous books, which was called First Bite. I'd say I had this kind of complicated relationship with food and my own body, probably from my teenage years up into my early 20s. And then it just changed. I became happy around food again. I just was able to reclaim my own appetite. And some of that was just realizing, I think one of the terrible things we do in our culture is we put health food and pleasurable food in two different boxes. And what I discovered for myself was, you know, I still love cake and cookies and sweet things as much as the next person. And the last recipe in the whole book is my daughter's recipe for chocolate cake called Tasha's Never Fail Chocolate Cake. So this is not me saying you should only eat salad. But what I was able to do was somehow reach the point where instead of eating something like green vegetables because I thought I should, I was actually developing a taste for them. So then just the whole business of eating became so much simpler. I just focused on eating real food rather than processed food and gave myself permission to eat. And that was a wonderful process. So that was a kind of restoration in a way of the happy kitchen of my childhood. And then I think the later phase you're referring to of things becoming complicated again was I had three kids and life was so busy. And to my own surprise, I just suddenly felt that a lot of the time, my own cooking felt a little bit like a disappointment or a compromise. So I was partly writing the book thinking, how can I get back to that wonderful state of being in the kitchen with my mum making the cheese souffle?
So there was this during this period, there was this mismatch, I think you describe it as a mismatch in the book, between the meals you felt like you could make and the ones you actually did make. And I guess the book is, make a cookbook that goes further than other cookbooks that, as you say, start a little bit too late in the game. That is, a book that solves the problem of cooking, how to fit it into your everyday life, your imperfect everyday life. That's the idea.
Exactly. That is totally the idea. So I wanted to hold out a hand to anyone who was thinking, I wish I could cook more, but I can't because of X, Y, or Z. And those reasons will be different for all of us. I mean, some people, I think, just feel, the more I spoke to people, just feel daunted by cooking and feel it's almost as if cookbooks are speaking a foreign language, one that they can never really learn. And so I have a chapter called Teach Yourself to Cook with a Carrot. Because fundamentally, if your issue is you think that you can't cook, and actually anyone that knows how to eat, which is all of us, knows how to cook, because it's really just about putting flavors together that will give you pleasure and applying heat at a certain point, or not if you're making a salad.
There's another personal dimension to the story that you write about. I'm not sure how much you want to talk about, but about a year into the book project, and in the middle of the pandemic, you write about how your husband left you. And you say, to your surprise, the kitchen was one of those few places where you actually felt better at that time rather than worse. How cooking kind of anchored you to the person you had been before. Talk a little bit about this person. Because the thing that I wanted to know was, how did that difficult personal part and that revelation you got from it, I wonder how that changed the book project?
To me, it made the book project even more real, if that makes sense. So I'd, as you say, I was about a year into the project and I'd written a book proposal and I'd said all of this stuff in the proposal about how so far from being a cause of stress, cooking can be a salve and cooking can help us. And then, yeah, my husband of 23 years, he left at the end of, in the UK, the first pandemic lockdown quarantine we had ended in June 2020. And I'd said that cooking was something comforting and something that could salve you for pain. And I was suddenly given this immense pain. And I was there cooking for our two younger children. Our oldest child was locked away in a different town where he was studying. And I was sort of shown the truth of it day by day. It was, I'd written this stuff and then I was like, oh, this is really strange. Cooking is actually working. It is not quite, you know, I'm not saying cook your way and you will mend a broken heart. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that of all the things I tried, and I would try reading books and then I'd kind of have evenings where I just drank a bit too much wine and that certainly didn't make me feel any better. And when you've been with someone that long, I mean, I was 19 when I met him, so many associations in the house, in my head, were just bound up with him. And then cooking was a kind of time travel where I could be holding my mother's wooden spoon and it was connecting me with this person I was before I'd met him in this way that nothing else except perhaps music could do. And that was so powerful. And again, I'd have these days where, you know, I'd been so sad the day before and trying not to cry in front of the kids, not always succeeding by any means. And then the next day, my youngest son, who was 11 at the time it happened, he's like clockwork. He wakes up so early every day and had to get up for his breakfast. And I was making him a lot more pancakes and waffles than usual because it just seemed like some way I could kind of help them to kind of stay stay cheerful because you have to be allowed to be sad when you're sad. But anyway, pancakes, in my opinion, always help and waffles help even more. And I have a couple of waffle recipes in the book. The first draft of this book had probably four waffle recipes and then my editor kept saying, do we really need this many waffles? Anyway, I did need that many waffles. But just the act of making these hazelnut waffles for my son and cracking the eggs, as my mother had shown me all these years ago, and getting these roasted hazelnuts and adding vanilla essence and the whole kitchen filling with this lovely toasty smell, and often feeling I didn't have much appetite myself, but were waffles there, so I was definitely going to eat. It helped me on so many levels. It kept me connected with the kids, and it was a connection with the past. And it sort of bit by bit, I felt it was slightly patching me together again.
I liked also that it seems like that, as you say, it didn't cure your broken heart, but you mentioned how it sounds like it kind of gave you a sort of focus as well. While there was a lot of stuff going on in your mind, when you're cooking, that does make you actually pay attention to what's in front of you, and you kind of forget, at least for a moment, I guess, the other stuff that's happening in your life.
I think this is one of the incredible powers that cooking has, and I think it becomes more valuable the more of our lives are spent online, whether it's in Zoom meetings or social media. The cooking is just inherently sensory. It engages all of your five senses, whether you've quite chosen to engage them or not. And it keeps your hands busy. And those things together are, I say this because food is my thing, but I've just been really struck. There's something about actually making something with your own hands that most of us, unless our day job is as a carpenter or an artist or something like that, we're deprived of that. And cooking feeds our senses in a way that not that many other activities do now.
You mentioned in the book that almost all of us have at least one cooking secret, you know, some kind of shortcut or trick. And it sounds like you sort of started collecting them in some way.
Yeah, I notice more and more that every time you talk to someone about their cooking life, and often, you know, everyday home cooks as opposed to chefs are very self-deprecating. They'll always say, oh, and I'm not a very good cook, or I don't do much, but I do this. And that so often people would say they were stuck in a rut, which was how I often felt myself with cooking for three kids. But then one person's cooking rut can be somebody else's brilliant new idea. You know, when you ask, what is the thing that you're cooking every single day? They tell you something and you think, oh, that's brilliant. I'd like to adopt that. So yeah, I did try to just, as much as I could while talking to people, collect their ideas and put them together with ideas I was accumulating from cookbooks written by other people. And realizing I think almost all of us have these little things that we think are nothing special because we do them the whole time. Whereas conversely, there are things that you kind of think are disproportionately difficult just because you've never done this. We all can get that kind of slight feeling of being threatened or defensive by cooking techniques that aren't familiar to us. Like so many people will either be a savory cook or a sweet cook. My mother-in-law, I never know whether to call her. I was my ex-mother-in-law, but that's ridiculous. She's still my mother-in-law. Anyway, that person who is my ex-husband's mother, who is an important person in my life, she's an amazing cook, but she just doesn't bake cakes. So every time I'd bake a cake, it could be the simplest sponge cake in the world, and she would think I'd somehow perform some magic trick. but she could just turn out an hollandaise sauce as if she was just doing nothing. And to me, that seems like a miraculous thing.
The food scholar and writer Bee Wilson, her book is called The Secret of Cooking, Recipes for an Easier Life in the Kitchen. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The food writer Bee Wilson says the times when cooking really counts isn't on the big production days like the feast tomorrow. It's the ordinary meals. It's Wednesday night, like around 5, and you're not sure what to make for dinner or even if you feel like it. Her latest cookbook has recipes, of course, but she also writes about the other ingredients in cooking, finding the time and the brain space and making your kitchen feel right. Before anything else, Wilson writes, cooking needs to be doable. Her book is The Secret of Cooking. You write about making the kitchen a place where you actually feel at home, like arranging things so you actually want to spend some time there. And one of the ways of doing this, you say, is starting with good smells. What do you mean?
I think it's one of the many, many neglected subjects in cookbooks that we don't really talk about good smells. And I was struck reading a cookbook from decades ago by the novelist Joseph Conrad's wife, Jessie Conrad. And she had talked about like the horrors of bad smells in the kitchen. And it struck me that it's still something that until you can sort of feel comfortable in your own kitchen, you're not really going to want to spend that much time there. So the thing I haven't said so far is that the book's called The Secret of Cooking. So I thought of that title. I knew about these things we've already discussed, the books of secrets, that they used to be full of potions. Then I had the title and thought, I really like this title, but I can't call the book that because I have no idea what The Secret of Cooking is.
Right.
And then so I thought, I was wandering around feeling like I have this great title, but I'm a fraud. Can't write this book. And then I thought of the second half of the sentence, which is, the secret of cooking is the person who cooks. Yeah. And I kept reciting this to myself. The more I thought about it, I couldn't think of a single counterexample. Like if you're a chef in a high-end restaurant cooking some amazing, fancy, multi-stage dishes with foams and jus and all sorts, you're the secret of cooking then as the chef. But for most of us, we are the secret. We are the people who are going to make the magic happen or not. And therefore, it makes sense to me that you should be kind to the cook. What that means is you should be a bit nicer to yourself in the kitchen. So you should think of it in a way as a workspace that you're trying to make as pleasant as possible. And that could mean music and it could mean good smells. So to me, sometimes when I just want to lift my mood, I think if you just have fresh herbs in the kitchen, it's partly about adding flavoring to your cooking. It's partly that if I have a bag of mint either in my fridge or I have some mint growing in the garden outside in summer, you can just tear a leaf and smell it. And who doesn't feel better inhaling the scent of mint? Having kind of colours that please you and having, I think we all actually, whether we think about it or not, have certain utensils that feel better in our hand than others. And they almost feel like an old friend. So I think it's paying attention to all of those little ways. I mean, I say at one point that your own mood is the missing ingredient in every single recipe, because really it's the desire to cook that's going to get you there. It's the desire to cook. It's making it doable. And yeah, start with making the kitchen somewhere you want to be. And that may sound a bit utopian. And I realize part of why cooking is so hard for so many of us is, you know, you can't necessarily control the atmosphere if you're living in a shared apartment. So I'm not saying it's always possible to be living in some dream kitchen with fancy, expensive gadgetry. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying there are these small little steps that each of us can take to make our own mood a little bit better as we cook. And if you can identify what those are for you, just do them.
Say a little bit more about good sounds. That means you mentioned you have sometimes a Stevie Wonder song in mind or a Beatles song. And it's kind of like a playlist, I guess, or something.
I'm strongly convinced that music and food are related. And I think this is borne out by science, that the part of the brain responsible for memory is also very much activated both by music and food. And actually, one of the other pieces of context writing the book was that while I was writing it, my mother, who sadly died a year ago after I finished work on it, but she had dementia, and that taught me so much about the power of food and music to trigger memory, because the two things that could almost restore her to her former self were either giving her something delicious to eat. There's a pear and ginger cake in the book that was totally developed with her in mind, because she loved pears and she loved ginger, but you could give her a slice of this cake and she'd have this beautiful smile that was suddenly the same person she'd been, or playing her music. She'd start tapping her toe even like long after she couldn't say my name. She hardly knew who I was, but she recognized the music. So sorry, that's a long digression from, yeah, music in the kitchen. I say at one point, if you it took me ages to figure this out, but every time I was timing recipes using a timer, I would slightly feel this pressure and sort of the heater was on and I had to get going and it was kind of like, the clock is ticking. But I also found that if I could start timing things sometimes by songs instead, mm-hmm. and especially things like washing the dishes, which I don't particularly enjoy, I will literally say to my son after dinner most evenings, I'll say, oh, I think this is a 2-song job to do the dishes, or it's a 3-song job if we've really dirtied lots of pans, or it's a 1-song job if I've been super organized because I've actually done lots of clearing as I go. And as you mentioned, there are certain artists or composers I will turn to. My son just adores the Beatles, but their songs are quite short. Whereas Stevie Wonder, who we also both love, his songs, well, they're so just make you want to dance in any case. So that gets you in a good vibe. But also his songs are really long. Some of them you put on As by Stevie Wonder and you're still there 8 minutes later. And the time has just flown by.
You write that another thing you need to decide on before you start is whether you are a recipe follower or a recipe rebel. Which are you, and how does one figure out where you fit?
I mean, I think I am a recipe rebel who is trying to teach myself more to be a recipe follower.
Right.
And so it's quite strange in a way that I've written a cookbook because I'm always improvising and always thinking I can substitute that for that and that's going to come out great.
Yeah.
And I feel quite confident to do that. But sometimes I do think there's an absolute virtue, particularly the first time you cook something, in trying to follow it. But what I'm saying there is people get quite upset with recipes one way or another. So I think if you're a recipe follower, you sometimes just get upset by phrases like a handful of this or a pinch of that, because you want to be told half a teaspoon of salt exactly, and this is going to take 10 minutes. And then if you're a recipe rebel, you kind of get annoyed with too much pedantry and you can feel slightly boxed in and you think, come on, just give me a few options here. But I think the key thing is just recognizing in yourself which one you are, and then selecting your recipes accordingly. But I think it sometimes is a question of mood, because there are times when I can turn into someone who actually, there's a kind of paid to by numbers element, isn't there? In when you have a recipe and you think, I'm absolutely going to follow it to the letter. And that feeling of obedience, I think actually when I'm very stressed, sometimes taking a slightly elaborate recipe by someone like Jota Motulenghi and doing every single stage, including the garnish, there can be a deep satisfaction in that.
Yeah, but it got me thinking about how, and I hadn't thought about this, how recipes work or don't work, because you have a section on that, that all recipes are incomplete. And you say that even great recipes, all recipes are like an instruction manual. You say, with half of the steps missing. What do you mean?
So what I mean is, and I only kind of fully realized the truth of this. I half have known this for years, but it's only the process of trying to write recipes myself where I realized how hard it is, because you're taking a fundamentally sensory, practical activity, which, as I've said, is largely in your hands. Yeah. And you're trying to translate that into black and white words on a page. And then you're expecting that someone else in a completely different kitchen with a completely different upbringing from you and maybe a different set of knowledge about flavors or cuisine or culture is going to take your black and white words on a page and translate it with their own hands into something real in their own kitchen. I mean, that's the whole magic of it. It's a beautiful form of transmission. But of course, there are going to be misunderstandings along the way, because when I began writing recipes, I realized, if you were to write a really perfect foolproof recipe, it would go on for 10 pages. And therefore, it wouldn't be a perfect recipe because it wouldn't solve anyone's life problems, because it couldn't possibly be quick because it would take so long to read. So all recipe writers have to make these assumptions about what you know. And I talk in the book about this conversation I had with a brilliant British writer called John Lanchester, who he's mostly a novelist, but he used to be a restaurant critic here in the UK. And he had this thing about how when he was first learning to cook, it seemed to be going quite well. And then he came to this recipe, obviously this is pre-internet when he was doing it. And it used the word fold. And he thought, I actually just don't know what that means. Like, fold like a book? How do you fold something? And he just was completely stuck. I mean, there's something extraordinary about cookbooks because they're, unlike other literary forms, unlike a book of short stories or a book of poems, the book of poems is just trying to, well, it's trying to take you somewhere, but it's not requiring that you do something. Whereas the cookbook is actually trying to say, take my words and spring into action with them. And of course, the cookbook writer can't know everything that you know and don't know. And again, in that section, I quote, there's a 19th century Italian food writer called Pellegrino Artusi, who's still an absolute icon in Italy. And he says, everyone, starting with the jackass, knows how to make meatballs, so I'm not going to tell you how to do it. And I read that and think, well, no, I didn't know how to make meatballs. I had to read a Marcella Hazan recipe. That's so obviously a laughable assumption, isn't it? Like, you can't just go up to the average person on the street and say, do you know how to make meatballs from scratch? And, you know, the vast majority of people would not, would they? But that was an assumption he felt he could make in his own particular milieu in 19th century Italy. And I've met quite a lot of top cookbook writers, people like Nigella Lawson, people like Yota Motulenghi. They're absolutely just trying to give you pleasure with their words. But they don't know what you know and don't know. So it's kind of, it's always slightly a guessing game. And I think as a reader, the more you can just settle into the thought that, okay, this recipe is a starting point, but it can't do everything. I'm going to be the one who's going to bring it to life. That then you give yourself a bit more credit and give the recipe a bit less credit, which is how it should be.
Can we talk about your butter braised asparagus recipe? Because it's it's a really great example of another important idea you write about in the book, that there is always another way of doing something. Talk about that one, and talk about the fact that you don't necessarily need to, even if a recipe calls for it, preheat the damn oven all the time.
That was a revelation to me, yes. So I think one of the many ways in which we can get boxed in by ideas of cooking is thinking that you should cook certain things in certain ways. And like with asparagus, I was so hung up for years on the idea that you could only steam it. And then I discovered, or I call it grilling, you'd call it broiling. So I just, it's so confusing, the different terminology of British cooking versus American cooking. And I have to keep reminding myself, because my sister lives in Philadelphia, so I know some of it, but then there are other things that I forget. Anyway, so I, yeah, then got into broiling asparagus or sometimes searing it. And then I just discovered actually that to me, the best of all ways, but I'll probably change my mind again next year, was I came across a J. Kenji Lopez Alt recipe for braised asparagus. And I was like, oh, this is amazing, because you can kind of have the caramelization of the roasted asparagus, but then you also get some of the lightness of the steamed asparagus. And then it's got a bit of buttery sauce still there. But really, it isn't just about asparagus. As you've said, it's trying to say, there's always another way of doing something in the kitchen. These things are not absolute rules. So almost every recipe starts with the instruction, heat the oven or preheat the oven. And it's partly just recipes are things where they follow a certain format often, and the writer is wanted to get that part out of the way. But in an era where we're all trying to think a little bit more about how do we not waste as much energy, it's kind of useful to know, I then came across a whole set of recipes where the authors weren't telling you to preheat the oven. So I came across a French recipe for roast chicken, which staggered me, where he said, actually, poultry is more tender, in his opinion, if you start it in a cold oven. And I tried it, and then I thought, oh, this is delicious. And I'm not saying I never would preheat the oven. If I already had the oven on, because maybe I was roasting some vegetables, I would absolutely put the chicken into that hot oven. But I'm just saying, look, here's a different way. And even with a cake, this was the one which really surprised me. But there are actually quite old recipes for pound cake that say, because with a pound cake, you're going for a much kind of denser, more pebbly texture than you would go for with something like a chiffon cake or a, you know, those really airy angel food cakes. Those would want to go in a preheated hot oven. But With a pound cake, where you're going for a slower rise, again, the cold start is actually good. Plus, it kind of saves you time because you've preheat the oven. It's always one of those things where you think, oh, darn it, I should have done that 15 minutes ago, and now I'm 15 minutes behind.
Okay, this part may maybe disappoint a few people, but to me it seemed like a revelation. You say cooking is mostly about washing dishes. Tell the Alan Davidson story, if you would.
Yeah. So I had a dear friend and mentor, a man called Alan Davidson, who he spent 20 years writing what I think is the greatest food reference book ever written, The Oxford Companion to Food. He was a very eccentric man and he loved wearing Hawaiian shirts. And he claimed that he loved washing dishes. And I kind of always thought, really, Alan? But he wrote one of the all-time great essays in the Oxford Companion to Food about the joy of washing dishes. And he said, if you were to look at the meal as an anthropologist might look at it, kind of, or someone from Mars, you would think that the person washing dishes was actually the powerful person who was completing the ritual while the kind of the followers were just kind of lolling in their chairs. And then this priest-like person is standing up doing this elaborate cleansing ritual. Anyway, I read that essay years ago and never really fully bought into it, but thought, great that it gives Alan so much pleasure. But then as the years went by, and actually it's another thing that in a way I have to thank my ex-husband for leaving for, because he, in our marriage, I did the vast majority of the cooking, and he, for which I was very grateful at the time, did the vast majority of the washing up. Mm. Suddenly I was plunged into being the person that washed the dishes every day. And I suddenly realized I've actually just got to make my peace with this process. Mm. So it's like the day after day, I was kind of thinking, oh, more dishes again. And then thinking, well, I love cooking, but I don't enjoy washing dishes. But then I realized that was kind of crazy talk, because if every day that I was washing dishes, I was feeling annoyed about it, then I was sort of going to feel annoyed about cooking too. So I'm not saying that washing dishes is my favorite part of cooking. I'm always going to enjoy something like whisking eggs or melting butter or chopping green herbs more than I would enjoy getting out dish soap and a washing up brush and scrubbers. But I found that, as with the timing things by song, if you put some music on and you just think, this is part of the process, and there is, as Alan said, there is a certain satisfaction in restoring order. And I think, as with anything else in the kitchen, you kind of have to find your own system.
Yeah.
And your own system may be getting a load of recipes that are one pot dishes that require so little washing up you can minimize it. I mean, that's a very cool approach if you can pull that one off.
Bea Wilson, her latest book is called The Secret of Cooking: Recipes for an Easier Life in the Kitchen. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The acclaimed British food writer Bea Wilson has a cookbook where you'll find all kinds of recipes, of course. Miso glazed eggplant, red curry sauce, polenta crisp oven fries. But before you get to the food part, her book is designed to get you in the right frame of mind. So there are chapters about embracing a routine, how to not feel guilty if you don't make something from scratch, how to reduce your options, how to play some music in the kitchen. Wilson says she wants you to fit cooking into the everyday mess and imperfection of your life. Her book is The Secret of Cooking. I have a British mother-in-law who is a terrific cook. The first meal she made for me when I met her, she said to me, because I salted the food before I tasted it, she said to me, do you always salt your food before tasting it? And that story came to me in your chapter on seasoning. You say seasoning is about noticing. What do you mean?
So I mean, seasoning is really paying attention. both to your own taste. So that's an interesting comment, because maybe you just have a saltier palate than her. Did you taste it and then think it didn't need salt? Or were you happy you added salt?
I think it was just an impulse. I think I've always done that. And I know I have a saltier palate than she. And I know I have a saltier palate than my wife. She's constantly telling me that.
So actually, maybe it did need the salt to you. I mean, I get what she's saying, but it's kind of the wrong way around, that you need to taste it first, see if it needs the salt, and then add it or not. And some cooks do get very offended by it. I'm never offended. I just think we all just have differing tastes, just like some people from other things in chili, don't they, before they eat it. And yeah, my daughter just went through a sriracha phase where she just had to have sriracha, and then it was the chili crisp oil, and it just, we're all different. But so yeah, when I say seasoning is really about noticing the seasoning chapter, which is called Find the Missing Element. But I'm trying to say, sometimes there's more to seasoning than we think. And sometimes, rather than adding more salt, you actually want water. So I have a whole section on water being the most forgotten element in the kitchen. And that it was kind of news to me that you could, when making a salad dressing, just a basic vinaigrette, that if you just add a touch of water, it just kind of lightens it and softens out all of the other flavors in a way that's very pleasing.
There's this quote you use in one of the chapter headings by Christopher Kimball, who says the problem with most home cooks is that they have too many recipes rather than too few. And this is a section you describe as reducing your options. And you write about the, as you say, the sweetness of routine. What is he getting at? The fact that we have too many recipes rather than too few? And what are you getting at with the idea of just reducing your options?
So I think what Christopher Kimball's getting at is that if you spend hours and hours just trying to figure out what to make for dinner, that actually gets in the way of the task in front of you, which is just making dinner. And so often I think, just as I've said, cooking is mostly about washing dishes. The other thing that I think hugely stresses people out, and even though it can be an absolute joy if you're doing it in an expansive way at the weekend, is the food shopping. But even before the food shopping is that planning and deciding stage and just knowing what you're going to cook. So the idea of reducing your options, I have a section called, I think it's called something like Repertoires and Rituals, in which I have a whole series of dishes which were inspired by people in my life who were important to me. And what I'm trying to say is, a bit like when you go to a restaurant and you can't decide what wine to order, so you think, oh, it's fine, I'll just have the house wine. And you know that the person who's bought that restaurant has thought very hard about choosing a wine that's going to be affordable and drinkable and will go with most of the dishes on the menu. That's the hope anyway. Mm. And there's something very relaxing sometimes about the concept of house wine. And if you could do the same with a series of dishes of just saying, okay, this is my house version of this, and this is what we're going to have on a Wednesday night. So it's just about building up your own set of dishes so that when you have that thing of thinking, oh, people are coming around, I have nothing to cook, I have no idea what to cook, you think, no, I do. I have 6 or 10 utterly reliable recipes that I like the taste of, which I can serve to a range of friends with different dietary requirements, and which means something to me. So that's why I linked mine to people, because I think sometimes when you lose confidence in your own ability to choose a delicious series of dishes, if you think, oh, well, this was good enough for that person. So I have one recipe which, sorry, try not to burst into tears, which was named after a friend called Richard, who very sadly died during the pandemic, aged 54, much too young. And I wanted to dedicate a recipe to him. He was the most wonderful man. And I remembered having gone on holidays with him and his wife when our kids were younger. And his wife is French and she's called Claire. And she would make these huge vats of ratatouille. And she would say, ratatouille. She'd add this extra syllable. And I just remembered this huge smile on his face when she set it on the table. And even though the ratatouille in my book is not quite Claire's recipe, it's more designed to look like the ratatouille in the Pixar film, because that's what my son wanted.
Right.
There's something about having made it in honor of him that gives me that extra reason to cook, which I think sometimes that's what you need. You need a sort of sense of, well, okay, I'm going to make that to honor someone, and therefore it's definitely good enough.
How do you stop throwing away perfectly good food? This is one of those things you mention in the book, when people feel that sense of anxiety sometimes in the kitchen. They feel like things are rotting in the fridge. What do you do? Do you have a technique?
I think you actually need a series of techniques. I mean, one of the things with food waste is you need to be thinking about it at the shopping stage rather than just, again, so late in the game. If you are that late in the game, we've talked about being a recipe follower or a recipe rebel. If ever there were a time to be a recipe rebel, it's when you're trying to avoid food waste. Because if you're always just cooking exactly to the ingredients in a recipe, admittedly, in the age of the internet, you can type three ingredients in and the search engine may come back with something you can make. But the more that you can get in the habit of thinking, okay, well, I have this recipe that says I should use cabbage, but I've got kale in the fridge instead. Right. I think that's going to work. And that way I'm not going to waste that second half of the kale that I used in a dish yesterday. Those are the kind of things that mean that you actually use up most of the old vegetables in your salad drawer. Because I think food often becomes waste in our mind before it actually becomes waste in reality. There's a sort of point where everything is so appetizing when you've just got it back from the market or the store. And then it just becomes progressively less appetizing by the day. And the secret is kind of grabbing it before it's actually beyond repair. So I have two sets of recipes. One is based on the idea that you buy a single cauliflower and you can eat it in three different ways across three successive nights. You could make it into a cauliflower cheese souffle. You can make it into a slightly Chinese flavored dish with soy sauce and cashew nuts and have that with rice. And it's got Sichuan pepper in, which I just love that kind of tingling that it does to your lips. And then there's a third one where you make it into a cauliflower pasta with capers and fennel seeds and mustard croutons. And that way, I think it's done lots of different things at once, that you've given yourself three different kinds of pleasure out of one cauliflower, which is not a bad thing. But you've also managed not to leave the sad leftover bit of cauliflower in the refrigerator.
So I'm not sure I need to remind you, but around here in the U.S., people are preparing for a rather large meal.
Yes.
Tomorrow.
Thanksgiving.
Yes. You say that most of us don't have enough feasts in our lives. So how are you thinking about the way, I guess, we're thinking about Thanksgiving?
I mean, as an outsider, I absolutely love Thanksgiving. And as I already mentioned, my sister lives in Philadelphia, and there were a couple of years where she and her partner and her three girls came over and celebrated Thanksgiving dinner in my house. And I just loved it as an excuse to make four different pies and lots of stuffing and side dishes and turkey. To me, it's heaven. I mean, because here we have a comparably big meal for Christmas. But then the problem with Christmas is you've got all of this focus on food, and then you've got to think about the presents and all of that consumerism of what else can I do to make Christmas special. Whereas I'm sure it doesn't always feel like that to someone that's cooking Thanksgiving dinner year after year. But what I love about Thanksgiving is this sense that food becomes the single greatest conversation for once. And my experience of having been in the States in the run-up to Thanksgiving, I love those conversations people are having about what are your feelings about creamed spinach and right. Should the potatoes always be mashed? And if so, what's the best way to mash a potato? And I sort of think if we could take some of that spirit of Thanksgiving and bottle it and have it for the rest of the year, we'd be so much happier. That wonderful sense of anticipation of thinking, how am I going to flavor the stuffing this year? And how am I going to make it just the best stuffing? Do you make raw cranberry sauce or do you make cooked cranberry sauce? Mm. Oh, I love it.
I wanted to end with the idea of love. You mention this, something the Danish cookbook author Trine Hahnemann said, that cooking has to be done with love. Maybe say something about that, finally.
So many of us think cooking can be an act of love if we're doing it for these big ceremonial meals like Thanksgiving. Mm. But her point was that even if she was just throwing together a quick soup for herself, or even a sandwich, or she was just cooking breakfast for her husband, she wanted to give that the same love as if she was cooking a huge feast meal. And I think there's real wisdom in that. I mean, many of us have a sense that cooking can be an act of love, but to return to the theme of cooking alone, it's a kind of love we often withhold from ourselves. And I think all of us would be happier in the kitchen. One of my maxims is, if you could cook for yourself as if you were company, and if you could cook for other people as if you were cooking for yourself, then we'd somehow get closer to some truth about what cooking really should be.
Bee Wilson. Her book is called The Secret of Cooking, Recipes for an Easier Life in the Kitchen. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments or ideas or feedback, you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.